The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Thank you all for being here. My name is Michael Peretz, and I am the president of the Federalist Society here at UNC Law. It's great to see so many of you here today, and great to have three tremendous speakers to talk about the Supreme Court preview that we've done every year for the past few years, and I'm looking forward to hopefully having this in the future, even for years to come. And I'll introduce our first speaker, Anthony Sanders, and then he will introduce the next two speakers. So Anthony Sanders is the director of the Institute of Justice's Center for Judicial Engagement and a senior attorney. And as a senior attorney, he litigates cutting-edge constitutional cases, protecting economic liberty, private property, freedom of speech, and other individual liberties in both federal and state courts across the country. Please give a round of applause for our speakers, and thank you guys so much for coming once again.
Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you to the chapter for the University of North Carolina Law School for inviting us here. And thank you to Michael and everyone for setting it up. It is extremely exciting for the Center for Judicial Engagement and the Institute for Justice to be back here this year. I was not here last year. My much brighter and funnier predecessor, Sheldon Gilbert, led this last year. But an even brighter and funnier person, Justin Pearson, is back, who was here last year. We are very happy to be have him joined by Professor Hesek also. And we will be introducing them in a couple minutes. First, I'd like to get some preliminaries out of the way. Again, I work for the Institute for Justice. We are a nonprofit public interest libertarian law firm that has offices around the country, and we have clerks from around the country who work for us every summer. So please feel free to apply to our clerkships come early December, I think, is when they open up, maybe even November. Watch our website, ij.org, either for those here in the audience or for those listening. And for those in the audience, should be aware, this is going to be podcasted. And of course, a podcast can be listened to anyone on earth. So hello, everyone else on earth who's listening to our SCOTUS preview for the 2019 term. We're going to hear an in-depth analysis of a few of the cases that are either there or might be there later this term from our distinguished panelists in a moment. But first, we're going to have a little fun and learn through losing of money. That's right. So this is SCOTUS Geography Jeopardy, the show where there is only one category. That category is where on earth a case comes from in the United States. There's a story I heard in law school, which is that Chief Justice Rehnquist, when he was on the bench before an argument, would page through a Rand McNally atlas and try to find the town where the case he was about to hear came from. So in honor of that, we are going to ask these contestants who have just entered the studio about where on earth these cases have come from. First contestant is Justin Pearson, who is from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He is also just happens to be the managing attorney for the Institute for Justice's Florida office. He oversees our economic liberty efforts and litigates around the country. Also here is Professor Andrew Hesek, who is from right here, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He is the Judge John J. Parker Distinguished Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Strategy. He's been here since 2016. Before then, he had a distinguished career, and he clerked for two different circuit court judges, which means I'm sure he's a fan of our Short Circuit newsletter and podcast, which the Center for Judicial Engagement puts out quite regularly. The newsletter comes out every Friday. If you haven't signed up, please sign up today. So this will be a lot like the Jeopardy you know and love, except we're going to alternate who's going to answer. If they don't get it right, we'll go to the next one. And then we'll throw it out to the studio audience. And the winnings will be in imaginary dollars. We don't have to contract or give people gold and silver as the University of North Carolina would, which is subject to the legal tender clause of the U.S. Constitution. Look it up. It's in there. But because we're a private organization, we're not bound by that. So we're going to go with imaginary dollars.
This is not what I was told.
The first question is for Justin. And remember, your response must be in the form of a question. A Second Amendment case for this term emanates from the hometown of this Jeopardy host.
Well, I mean,
so remember, there's the a Second form Amendment of case. A question.
So, well, I'm going to think it through a little bit. So, I know there's a Second Amendment case from New York, but so
this Jeopardy.
I know, but he's Alex Trebek isn't from
all
New
right,
York.
You're
but,
done.
Who
not
is Alex Trebek?
Question.
All right.
Wrong.
All right.
Wrong.
There you go.
Yes.
If it's not Alex Trebek, I have no idea.
Also, not the form of the question. The correct answer is, who is Art Fleming? Art Fleming, the original host of the original Jeopardy series, which ran from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s.
I'm not young, and I wasn't born.
I was going to say, anyone younger than me would have no idea what the answer to this. I only know this because my biology teacher in high school, Mr. Green, would lecture us on how far superior host he was to Mr. Trebek. So shout out to you, Mr. Green, if you're listening. I, however, do very much like Mr. Trebek. Let's move on. Negative 100 imaginary dollars to each of you we'll collect at the end of the show. Professor Hesek, this municipality argues that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 does not prohibit sexual orientation discrimination.
Municipality. What is Atlanta?
Wrong.
I mean, it is in Georgia. I don't remember the town.
I'll give you that, Georgia. Clayton County.
I knew it was Georgia. You said municipality.
And cool. Neither of you did it in the form of the question, but we'll let that slide. Yes, Bostock versus Clayton County, Georgia. This is about whether the phrase "on the basis of sex" in the Civil Rights Act applies to sexual orientation discrimination.
Thanks,
and
Anthony.
And I'm sorry, in my
your imaginary check is in the mail.
What is the answer?
I appreciate it.
Actually, Vimo is fine. I should go back to the other case. That, of course, the Second Amendment case. A lot of people have been talking about New York State Rifle Association versus City of New York is about whether it violated the Second Amendment to a law that New York City used to have, that you couldn't remove a gun from the city. Let's move on. Another question for Justin. A board of this jurisdiction allegedly wasn't appointed constitutionally, but the Second Circuit said it was okay under the de facto office doctrine.
Well, I'm going to say what is Puerto Rico, but if I'm right, that's the First Circuit.
That's right, Puerto Rico. And what there was a number of cases that were consolidated, and it's about whether these gentlemen and women were appointed constitutionally, whether they are confirmed by the Senate. Or whether they needed to be concerned by the Senate. Let's move on.
How many fake dollars do I get?
That was actually 300. Yeah, I think you're in the black now. So Professor Hesek, no less than three cases feature this state in criminal matters this term.
let's go with what is California?
Incorrect, Justin.
I'm going to say, what is Georgia?
Incorrect. Anyone in the audience? Yes. What is Kansas is the actual answer, but very good. Yes. Three cases from the Supreme Court of Kansas on criminal matters this term. One is a Fourth Amendment case. One's an immigration case about sensitive information. And one's about the elimination of the insanity defense. That'll be argued next week. Next, Justin, the court will decide whether to overturn this precedent when incorporating in the Big Easy.
Oh, so that's the requirement for a unanimous jury trial. What is the requirement for a unanimous jury trial?
I'll give you that. It's Apodaca versus Oregon, but that's what it's about. The case is Ramos versus Louisiana, about whether the requirement in the Sixth Amendment, interpreted into the Sixth Amendment, of a unanimous jury in criminal matters, whether that applies to the states and whether they need to overturn that precedent. Professor Hesek, this state is the origin of a case on whether to Bivens or not to Bivens.
What is Texas?
That's right. Texas, Hernandez versus Mesa, a case on implied remedies and whether they're required by the Constitution, Bivens being the precedent that has been narrowly interpreted to allow that in some cases. Just a couple more. Justin, there is some dreaming in this state in trying to help the dreamers.
What is California?
Absolutely correct. That, of course, is one of the DACA cases, DHS versus Regents of the University of California, the deferred action for childhood arrivals, whether that's been lawfully rescinded. Professor Hesek, this state thinks it owns the law. Hey, what about the people?
What is Georgia?
Absolutely correct. I was about to go beep, 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 but he beat me to it. Yes, the government edicts doctrine, whether the annotations to the Georgia statutes can be copyrighted. Finally, Justin, we will have no final Jeopardy, unfortunately, but last question. This is actually, I forgot about the money, but $800 imaginary dollars. A case from here is a wowie from the point of view of the Clean Water Act.
What is Maui?
Absolutely correct. County of Maui, Hawaii. We were actually talking about this before the show, versus Hawaii Wildlife Fund, a Clean Water Act about point source requirements. Now moving on to the actual program, we're going to hear from Justin for a few minutes about one case that I'm very angry he has, because even though my colleagues at Institute for Justice are litigating it, I have a really good Jeopardy question I was going to use about it. Then we're going to hear from Professor Hesek, and then we're about another case. Then we're going to hear about some cases that might be coming to the court, and then we'll throw it out for your questions. So let's move on to Justin.
Sure. So I'm going to talk about Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. This is a case that will be argued by our colleagues at IJ, probably sometime around January. It will be IJ's ninth U.S. Supreme Court case. I should point out that in our previous 8 Supreme Court cases, we won 7 of them. Hopefully this will be number 8. But I'm not just talking about it because it's an IJ case. It also presents a fascinating issue to the court, which is whether a pro-bigotry state constitutional amendment violates the U.S. Constitution. And what I'm referring to is something called a Blaine Amendment. 37 state constitutions have Blaine Amendments. By the way, kudos to North Carolina. You are one of the 13 states that does not have one of these bigoted Blaine amendments, so well done. But basically, these amendments are named for a 19th century U.S. senator named James Blaine, who wanted to seize on anti-immigrant bias, generally, and more specifically, anti-Catholic immigrant bias, and ride that wave of bigotry to the White House. And so what he did, I should point out, as some of you may know historically, there was a wave of Irish immigrants in the 1800s. And so there was this backlash where amongst so-called nativists saying, you know, America is for Americans, and claiming that we're a Protestant country, and worrying that these so-called Catholic invaders will want to change our culture and so on. And so James Blaine introduced an anti-Catholic U.S. constitutional amendment that thankfully was not adopted, and his presidential campaign didn't succeed either. But Blaine and his allies were able to get 37 states to adopt these anti-Catholic state constitutional amendments, oftentimes by making it a requirement for allowing a new state to join the union. And what these amendments did is they focused on the school system. Back then, and like much of our nation's history, it might surprise some of you to know that public schools used Bibles, specifically Protestant Bibles. Many Americans learned how to read from reading Protestant Bibles in public schools. And so one of the complaints made by the bigots against the Catholic immigrants was that, you know, these Catholics might not want their kids to be taught out of Protestant Bibles in the public schools. They might want to use their own Bibles, and we want to make things, you know, the bigots want to make things as uncomfortable and unwelcoming for the Catholics as possible. And so what the Blaine Amendments do is they say that no tax money can ever be used to directly or indirectly aid a so-called sectarian school. That's just another word for Catholic. That was the term for Catholic in the time. And so basically what that does is that means that not only can a Catholic Bible never be used in a public school, as opposed to the Protestant Bibles that were used, but no money can ever be used even to indirectly help any type of Catholic private school. Now, because the prejudiced and just awful and ugly history of Blaine Amendments is so well known, you can imagine that they're not often relied upon in court. I mean, you've got to be pretty desperate to basically hang your hat on that argument when the history is so clear that these amendments exist for one reason, and that one reason is anti-Catholic bias. But lately, one group has become that desperate, and that is the group consisting of teachers' unions, specifically in educational choice cases. For those of you who don't know, and this is an overgeneralization because, you know, we're short on time, but educational choice basically gives kids, usually disadvantaged kids in failing schools, an option for leaving their particular public school. Oftentimes it's in the form of a tax credit to people who give scholarships to these kids. The kids can use the scholarships wherever they want. It could be a religious school, a non-religious school, you name it. IJ's actually had a couple of our U.S. Supreme Court wins on this issue. We tend to represent the kids and their parents who are the recipients of these scholarships. And because our victories have foreclosed the teachers union's federal constitutional arguments, they've turned to state courts. And it's really a shame because other than the teachers union, just about everyone likes these programs, right? I mean, it lets an underprivileged kid escape a failing school. It takes the remainder, it takes the unspent part of the money that the government would have spent on that kid's tuition, and it keeps it in the public school. So then the per capita, the per student spending in that school goes up. So it's win-win, but the teachers union hate these programs because it decreases their power. So left without any U.S. constitutional arguments, they've been turning to state constitutions, and they've gotten desperate enough that they now have been making these Blaine Amendment arguments. The most recent example is in Montana. Montana passed an educational choice program that gives a $150 tax credit to anyone who donates money to a third-party scholarship program. Those scholarship programs then compile the money and give it to deserving kids. When the case went up to the Montana Supreme Court, the Montana Supreme Court recognized that some of those kids and their parents might choose to go to Catholic school. They have choices, but they might choose Catholic school. And so that means that the program indirectly assists Catholic schools, which is the exact thing prohibited by Blaine Amendments. And so based solely on the Montana Constitution's Blaine Amendment, the Montana Supreme Court struck down this entire school choice program. Of course, that did tee up perfectly the question for the cert petition to the U.S. Supreme Court as to whether these Blaine Amendments themselves violate either the First or 14th Amendment, whether they violate either the First or 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Our colleagues filed that cert petition. Obviously, it was granted. The case will probably be argued in January. And I'm really looking forward to it for a couple reasons. First of all, you know, just as a matter of principle, these Blaine Amendments are a horrible thing. They're a remnant of a really ugly period in our history, and they should be held to violate the U.S. Constitution. But second of all, because 37 states have these Blaine Amendments, and they're all worded very similarly, a win here could potentially help tens of thousands of kids obtain a better education, and that's something I think we should all celebrate. So, you know, fingers crossed. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Justin. Now, Professor Hessick.
Hi. So I'm going to talk about a case a little bit more local. It's Allen versus Cooper. It starts a while ago. It starts back in 1717. It's Blackbeard. He was on his ship, Queen Anne's Revenge. That's when he got the ship. The ship subsequently went aground just off the coast of North Carolina near Beaufort. In 1996, they found the wreckage of the ship, and this guy, Frederick Allen, was hired to record the recovery, right, the salvage of the ship. Now, fast forward, North Carolina, the government, it starts using some of those recordings, some of those pictures, and Allen, he claims that's a copyright infringement. So he sued for violation of his copyright because he says North Carolina didn't pay him and that he was entitled to money. North Carolina, they respond. They say, hey, look, this isn't, we don't think we violate copyright. And even more important, we think we have sovereign immunity, right? Sovereign immunity, the idea is that individuals can't sue the states unless the states consent to be sued, right? The courts, it's a jurisdictional doctrine, actually. The courts don't have jurisdiction to hear claims against the state, the sovereign immunity. So in the federal system, sovereign immunity, it originally sort of derived from the 11th Amendment. It says that, which says judicial power doesn't extend to suits between citizens of one state in suits against another state, right? But over time, the Supreme Court has expanded it to be a much broader doctrine that says basically it's no individual can sue a state without the state's consent. And it's just sort of, it's said that this doctrine is sort of baked into the Constitution. You can't point to any particular clause that creates it. It's sort of there. They call it the postulates that guide and control. That's sort of, you know, that's the conservative analog to penumbras. Now Allen's response, I mean, that, you know, sovereign immunity, it's a big argument. Allen's response is, look, Congress passes federal law, the Copyright Remedy Clarification Act, and that law abrogates state sovereign immunity. And he's basically got two arguments to get him there. The first is Congress used its Article I power, the copyright power, to abrogate state sovereign immunity, right? So Article I, Section 8, Clause 8, says that Congress can sort of, you know, make laws for the advancement of the arts and sciences, basically. And they can use that power, Allen claims, to abrogate state sovereign immunity. The problem with this argument, right, what it's running up against is that in the 90s, there were two cases out of the Supreme Court that said that generally Congress can't use its Article I powers to abrogate state sovereign immunity. One of them, Seminole Tribe, right, that was the first one, it said you can't use the Indian Commerce Clause to do it. And then a few years later, the second one, the Florida prepaid case, it said you can't use the patent power, which actually is, you know, the same clause that they're relying on here. You can't use that power to abrogate state sovereign immunity. Right? Those are two big precedents that are in the way. The response to that, why this issue is actually you know, a possible issue before the court, is that there is a case from 2006, Katz, which said that Congress could abrogate under the bankruptcy clause. And Allen saying, hey, let's follow more in line with the bankruptcy clause case, the Katz case, than the older cases. It's a tough argument, though, because the court definitely did rely on sort of idiosyncratic features of the bankruptcy clause, right? That the clause says, hey, it should be uniform laws. It placed a lot of weight on that word in the clause. But more important, the court placed a lot of weight on the fact that bankruptcy jurisdiction is in rem, which means it's like over the thing versus over the person. And so they said it wasn't intruding on state sovereignty as much. And copyright doesn't really, it doesn't operate the same way. Sure, it involves property, but it's definitely in personam jurisdiction. I think the bigger problem, though, than the fact that like the Katz case is easily distinguishable and their precedents from the 90s that are much more on point. The bigger problem is that when it comes to sovereign immunity, sort of my sense is that a lot of methodological arguments, right, sort of like, hey, history, consistency, all this stuff, doesn't really matter that much. It seems to be driven much more by what the justices want, right? It's when originalism gets tossed out the window by the originalists, and it's when, like, you know, non-originalists start looking to originalism. They're just like, either I want sovereign immunity or I don't want sovereign immunity. And right now, so far as I can tell, right, based on last year's case, Franchise Tax Board versus Hyatt, which was a sovereign immunity case, in a different context, it was state versus state kind of sovereign immunity, but still, it involved sovereign immunity. We have five justices on the court who are very sort of hawkish on sovereign immunity, and that is not that's not great for Allen. Real quick, I'll say he does have another argument, Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. Unlike Section 1 of Article 1, Section 8, Section 5 of the 14th Amendment is recognized by basically everyone as a valid way of abrogating state sovereign immunity, but there are limits to when you can do it. Congress can abrogate state sovereign immunity when for state violations of constitutional rights, straight up violations. You deprive someone of due process, equal protection. You can waive sovereign immunity. And you can go a little bit further through what we call prophylactic legislation, so long as it's congruent and proportional. It doesn't go too much further than the constitutional protection. So if you have really bad constitutional violations, you can waive state sovereign immunity for something just a little bit broader than that. Winning on those kinds of arguments, though, is pretty tough to, you know, those prophylactic arguments is pretty tough. You have to build a good record of constitutional violations, and that's, you know, it's easy not to succeed at that kind of argument. You have to really document a lot of constitutional violations, and that the state law is really tailored at getting at those things, and that it's a really hard argument to make. And so, you know, I do think that they haven't really made a claim here, right? Allen hasn't really made a claim that there's a direct constitutional violation, that the violation of his copyrights were constitutional violations. Some of the amicus make that argument. It's there's a little bit of an argument there to be made, but it's pretty tough. I mean, there's a long way of saying that I think that that this could be a pretty hard argument for Allen, but it should be exciting to see. Any sovereign immunity case like this is always fun to watch.
Well, great. We'll be looking for both of those cases that are on the court's docket for this coming term, which the first conference for which is actually today, the long conference. But today, for people here today, not people listening on the podcast, October 1st, 2019. But then there's all these things called cert petitions and some appeals that get to the court, and many of which are cases, almost all of which actually, are cases that the court will never hear. Well, some of them are taken, though, about 70 to 80 cases a year, and our panelists now are going to talk about a couple cases that they think might be on their way, one of which I can say the man who's going to be talking very much hopes it's on its way, but out of the 7 to 8,000 cert petitions that go to the court a year, that these will be the ones that are taken. So first, we're going to hear from Justin, who is hoping that the case he's about to tell you about will be taken by the Supreme Court. Justin, tell us about this case.
Yeah, thanks. I can't help myself. I'm going to talk about a cert petition I'm writing right now, along with some of my colleagues. And it involves a widely abused process known as civil forfeiture. It shouldn't be confused with criminal forfeiture. Many of you are probably familiar with criminal forfeiture, which is where someone's convicted of a crime, and then their proceeds from that crime are taken, sold at, like, you know, an auction or something like that. That's relatively rare. The vast majority of forfeitures in this country are actually civil forfeitures, and in most of those, no one has been arrested, let alone convicted of anything. It's an outrage. Basically, the way it works, and it does change from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but at least the way it works federally, is if the government is suspicious of your property, they can seize it, and if you don't beat them in court, they get to keep it for themselves, which provides them with a tremendously perverse incentive to be very suspicious of everyone's property, especially if the person who owns the property happens to not have the resources to fight back. And so the way it works is, you know, the police seize your property or your money. Oftentimes it's your life savings. You go to them to try to get your money back or your property back, and they say, well, if you want, you can fight us in court, and it's going to take a couple years, and you're going to spend more on legal fees than the money or property is worth, but you can do that if you want, or you let us keep part, we give you back part, we all go our separate ways. It's just a shakedown. And that's standard operating procedure in much of this country. It's outrageous, but thankfully, to some degree, Congress tried to remedy some aspects of it in a law called the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act in 2000, or CAFRA for short. And one of the things that law did was it created an attorney's fees provision. And not only that, an attorney's fees provision that was supposed to make it even easier for civil forfeiture victims to recover their attorney's fees than many other prevailing party clauses. And what it said is, even if you only substantially prevail against the government in a forfeiture lawsuit, you should have all of your attorney's fees awarded. Unfortunately, the courts, at least many courts, have failed to follow the plain text of that statute. Very quickly, they started reading the word substantially right out of the statute and making it hard, just as hard, in some cases even harder, to get attorney's fees in civil forfeiture cases. So then what happens is the police still go around taking your money and property the way they always did. They still try to negotiate with you. It has nothing to do with fighting crime. It's just a negotiation, basically trying to use their leverage that they have over you because they have your life savings and you're going to have to fight for 2 years and spend tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees to get it back. And then if you actually are in the minority who can somehow afford to fight back and you fight for a couple years, then on the eve of summary judgment, If the government thinks they're about to lose and they might have to pay you your legal fees, they return your money or property, they move to voluntarily dismiss without prejudice, which is almost always granted, and then they say that because they voluntarily dismiss without prejudice, you don't get your legal fees. And most courts say they're right. It's an outrage. Not only does it not follow the plain text of the reform passed by Congress, it doesn't follow the intent. It's just it's unjust. Whatever criticism you can possibly levy against this practice, it would be valid, and this is a completely judicially made problem. All they had to do was follow the text, and at least now, so forfeiture wouldn't go away entirely, but at least the problem I'm talking about now would go away. You know, there was a case out of Miami, clients of mine who had this happen to them, despite the fact that my client received 100% of her money back after 2 years of fighting. The 11th Circuit held that she was not a prevailing, not a substantially prevailing party. So I'm filing a cert petition. Like Anthony mentioned, you know, the odds are long. The Supreme Court only grants about 1% of the cert petitions that are filed. I think this case has a better chance than most, but even still, it's going to be far below 50-50. But we think it's time well spent. It's a shot worth taking, because if by some chance the Supreme Court takes the case and instructs the lower courts to actually start following the plain text of the reform law, then all of a sudden you're going to see at least fewer of these shakedowns. And that's really all it is. It's the government taking your property and then negotiating with you to give you your own stuff back.
And Justin, what is the name of that case?
Well, so it's going to be titled Salgado versus the United States, which is unusual, right? So usually civil forfeiture cases, because they're in rem actions, they have these really wacky case names, oftentimes like the United States versus $450. My personal favorite is the United States versus one solid gold object in the form of a rooster, because you don't have to be convicted of anything. You don't even have to be accused of anything. It's the government saying this property seems suspicious, so we can take it. Now, the way it worked is there were multiple parties involved, and so my client, Melinda Salgado, is the petitioner, which is why it's Salgado versus United States. But the original trial court name of the case was United States versus $70,000 et al., and that's because there were different pieces of property in addition to the money. So it was the United States versus $70,000, and that's just silly. Fingers crossed.
Okay, thank you, Justin. Now on to Professor Hesick, who I think is going to take us out west, I believe, to the home of my predecessor, Sheldon Gilbert. Is it in Boise, Idaho?
That's right, Boise, Idaho. So the case I'm talking about, it's Boise versus Martin. So the case, it deals with homelessness. So Boise, it has a law that prohibits camping on the streets of Boise, and violation of this law is a misdemeanor. Maybe 6 months imprisonment, something like that. So Boise police, they sometimes enforce this law against the homeless. It's not the only group of people that they enforce it against, right? But sometimes against the homeless. Just telling them to move along, or you can't sleep here tonight. But other cities also have this kind of law. Los Angeles is an example. I actually filed an amicus brief in this case on behalf of some people who live in Los Angeles. So I know a bit about the Los Angeles situation. So Los Angeles has many homeless. It has about 60,000 homeless people. And a lot of the homeless come together in these encampments. And the police will sometimes use these anti-camping laws to break up these encampments. And the idea is, hey, look, you know, these encampments, they pose some health and safety risks. There's not good sanitation. A lot of people are living really close together. They're not up to code. So that creates disease. There's a lot of opportunity for crime. It's hard to report. It's hard to see what's going on. But also because everyone's so closely packed and using electricity or using wood that isn't up to code, it poses fire hazards, and sometimes it'll block the streets, right? So there's some problems with the encampment. So the Los Angeles police would occasionally, or law enforcement, it's not necessarily the police, would use these anti-encampment laws to break up these encampments. So what happened in this case, in the Boise case, is several homeless people, they challenged the Boise law, saying that it violates the Eighth Amendment for them for it to be a crime for them to sleep on the streets. And the theory is basically, look, we, you know, we're homeless. We don't have control over where we sleep. And so the law is punishing us for an involuntary act of sleeping on the streets. And that violates the Eighth Amendment. And the Ninth Circuit, it agreed. And it said you can't enforce these anti-encampment laws against people living on the streets unless you provide enough beds in shelters for the homeless, right? So you, at that point, they would say it's not involuntary, right? Because they could have gone to a shelter. They didn't. They chose to sleep on the street. So at that point, you could enforce it against them. This is a big deal, though, right? Because local governments, they generally have police power to regulate society, land use, tell people where they're allowed to sleep. And telling homeless people that they can't sleep on the streets, that would seem to fall within that power, right? And just the fact of striking down the law on Eighth Amendment grounds, that's a pretty good reason for granting cert. I mean, I know there usually has to be circuit splits and inconsistency with Supreme Court precedent. And there is some of that, which I'll talk about in a second. But also, you know, striking down laws is another reason that that often gets the court's attention. But anyway, there's also circuit splits here. The decision conflicts with California Supreme Court, 11th Circuit decision. And then there's some other circuits that have talked about involuntary laws generally. All of this is to say that, you know, odds are long on getting a cert grant in any given case. But this one, you know, it's teed up pretty well. It's a good vehicle. And there's there is a circuit split here, right? A pretty clean circuit split. But I do think that there's a... you know, an even bigger chance for cert than normal because of sort of just the significance of the case, right? I mean, it's not just that it's not just Boise that can't enforce its law, right? There are all these other cities in the Ninth Circuit, especially the cities in California, that have lots of homeless issues right now. I mean, just in the news the other day was of Oakland. Sort of knocking down one of its encampments or telling people to disperse. And you hear all these stories in the LA Times right now about the diseases and things like that that are in these encampments. And the president recently flew out to California and addressed this, like, precisely this issue. I mean, it's a big deal. And this was a major tool that California in particular used for dealing with this homeless problem. And it's now off the table. And the idea of having to create shelters for all of these people, for all the homeless people, before they can enforce the law, that's not really a viable solution, it would seem, because one, it's going to take a long time to build all those beds, and number two, it's going to be really expensive. I mean, they've been talking about, you know, sort of on the order of billions of dollars. You know, as always, no guarantee on cert, but I if you're ever going to say, hey, what case has a pretty good chance for cert, I think this one's pretty solid.
And thank you, Professor Hesick. And if I make a plug, our next edition of Bound by Oath, our documentary series, which you all should be binge listening to after this class or after this podcast, if you're listening to right now. We're not exactly in class, are we? It seems like it sometimes. Is on the homelessness issue and a case that IJ has had in Ohio. On some of these themes. So I encourage you to check that out when it comes out. We have a few minutes for questions. I'd ask if any of you have questions to come down to the mic down here and ask them and see if you can stump any of these experts on the Supreme Court. And it looks like we have one here right now.
So, Professor Hesick, in regard to the Queen Anne's Revenge case, if you will, what is the state's interest in litigating this? I mean, why not just pay the guy his his royalty fees? I imagine that would be cheaper than litigating this all the way to the Supreme Court. So I'm just curious what the state's interest in deciding this issue is.
And it's a good question. I don't immediately know. I mean, you would have to ask the state, but as a general matter, I think the states like to keep their sovereign immunity strong, right? And but I'm not quite sure.
And what wasn't the facts also? It was uploaded to the website, and like they wanted to defend that was okay for them.
Yeah, I mean maybe they do. Maybe they're like there's a lot more exposure to liability in the future, and maybe yeah, and maybe they don't want to be enjoined, something like that. But I imagine they could reach some sort of settlement, but they've chosen not to, and that's yeah, that's their prerogative.
Yeah. Another question here.
Yeah, I'll ask the last question before we close out. Last term, we saw a lot of weird concurrences and splits between different factions of the court. Do you expect that to continue in the upcoming term? And in what specific cases do you see potential the left and right coming together for certain issues or some weird splits in this term?
If I may start that off, I know the public perceives them as weird splits, and so I totally get why you'd say that. They're actually not that unusual. The different members of the Supreme Court agree far more often than they disagree. Most cases, the overwhelming majority of cases are not 5-4 splits. And so, first of all, you get unanimous court rulings far more often than the public realizes. But then even when the case is not unanimously decided, you get these groupings that I think surprise the public because you know they don't follow the court that closely other than for a few particular cases. So it's really not that weird, but you do tend to notice trends. And so, for example, one trend that you notice is Justice Gorsuch tends to team up with the so-called liberal wing quite a bit on criminal justice issues. I think perhaps that could also apply to my civil forfeiture cert petition. We'll see. You know, things like that. And when it comes to civil forfeiture, you know, Justice Thomas has become an outspoken critic of it. I know he has some allies on the supposedly left side of the court as well. So there are some topics where you notice those trends over time. But my overall point is that different people from different kind of philosophical approaches on Supreme Court will probably agree more often than you realize.
I think that's right. I will say I think that basically all of the cases that were brought up in the Geography Jeopardy today, though, are going to be somewhat divisive cases. maybe they were picked on purpose. But I, you know, looking through them very quickly, they seem sort of the usual 5-4 split kind of cases, if they're going to be divided, right? That they'd be 5-4 split. There's nothing that came up among those that I saw that's like lends itself to an odd arrangement that seems unexpected.
Do you have a prediction while we have you here on the DACA case, the admin law issues there?
So, I mean, the sort of easiest answer is to say, like, oh, you know, probably 5-4, right? Probably 5-4. Now, who gets the 5 is a little bit tricky. I'm not quite sure who will get the fifth vote. If I had to guess, I mean, this is wild speculation. I'd say, you know, the chief is the one that, like, might swing over, and I'm not quite sure which way it would go.
Gotcha. Similar maybe to the Department of Commerce case from the last term, the census case.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Okay. Well, thank you all so much for coming. Thank you again to the chapter for hosting us, the Federal Society chapter. And we'll see if any of these predictions or cases come true in the new term. But we'll all look forward to First Monday, which is just 6 days away.